Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, on the internet at hallel.info. We rightfully cringe at the bondage described in Leviticus chapter 25, verse 39 through 26, verse 2. But are the chains of debt on us today somewhat similar? In this study, we look at the Jubilee and the sabbatical year laws against today's student loans, consumer debt, and collapsing social trust. Parallel passage Isaiah 24 exposes what happens when nations cross God's economic and moral boundaries, while John 13 reveals a radically different master who uses authority to serve. Discover how biblical freedom resets identity, land, wealth, and power in a world trapped by debt and chronic anxiety.
It's one of the questions we have to ask in these particular passages is that really, is it the same as it ever was? I mean, we can think that we're so far detached from especially what we saw there in Leviticus 25. I mean, here in the United States, we think, oh, we've left all of this long behind with the time of, you know, it was a huge stain in this nation's history where you really had buying and selling of people. And it was despicable and it was awful. And hundreds of thousands of people died as a result of going back and forth and fighting to bring that to an end. But one of the things that's, you could say that we are not exactly debt servants in the legal sense, but you see in vision that's talked about in our Torah passages today and what we've seen here in recent weeks. But really, you can see that millions here in this country and around the world are experiencing, you could say, a similar economic dynamic. You know, your income is already committed to either housing or education or transportation or revolving debt. And your savings are thin. You got unexpected costs that come up and they require further borrowing. And younger adults, they're just increasingly depend upon either their families or they simply are financially not stable. And they have to then rely on all kinds of other things. There are some examples. These are all come through the Federal Reserve various studies and surveys that they've done. Younger Americans show substantially less financial security than older Americans. So in the 2025 survey of household economics and decision-making, they found that only 63% of adults ages 18 to 29 say they're doing okay or living comfortably financially, compared with 83% of those 60 and older. So you're saying then this is something that is declining year by year by year by year. And also in another study, the Federal Reserve found that nearly half of young adults need outside help to help meet their expenses. 47% of adults, 18 to 29, received financial help from someone outside their household last year. So that involves like general living expenses, housing costs, cell phone bills. So living on your own, extremely difficult. And it goes on. Many younger adults have very little financial cushion. Only 45% of adults ages 18 to 29 say they could cover a $400 emergency expense with cash or its equivalent last year. So for those adults 60 and older, 78% say they could do the same. And paying bills also is something that's disproportionately crushing on younger people. Last year, 24% of adults ages 18 to 29 did not pay all their bills in the previous month, compared with 9% of adults 60 and older. So struggling with bills. Many are talking about delaying their payments, borrowing, selling something, or putting their existing bills on credit cards. And especially if you're talking about paying off one credit card with another credit card. And it goes on. Student debt remains the major obligation of younger generations. So last year, 25% of adults ages 18 to 29 had outstanding student loans, compared with 16% of adults overall. So the New York Fed found that outstanding loan balances in the second quarter, so basically the first half of this year, $1.65 trillion. Wow. And then debt burdens can become very long-lived rather than merely being something you get in your youth. So the New York Fed also found that student loan defaults are increasing, and it's going up into older generations, even to people 50 and older. So this debt goes on and lives on and on, even past what you might think of as a mortgage period. They're going on and on over time. And so lastly, you just look at consumer debt overall. It's at historically large levels. The middle of this year, U.S. households carried $18.77 trillion in total debt. And 1.26, or about 10% of that, almost 10%, is credit card debt. $1.7 trillion in auto loans, $1.65 trillion student loans. Yeah. So credit card and auto loan delinquencies are continuing to go up. So with all this, we can see that really that the Torah is, when it's concerned, is about financial distress and from keeping financial distress from being a self-reinforcing cycle that people are trapped in it and they cannot get out of it, where debt just progressively just strips people of your freedom to operate. So when we get back to our topic here today, freedom for a broken world, we started saying that the modern situation, even though some of the circumstances have changed, has a lot of, you could say, echoes of the situation that Leviticus 25 and Isaiah 24 are talking about here. So when we look at the passages we looked at today, we can see some big ideas are that Adonai is rescuing his people from bondage so that they can belong to him. And, you know, you could say, just looking from the outside, go, well, what are we just trading one master for another? And indeed, yes. But the thing is that who is it who is worthy of serving? Because, you know, so someone once said, someone will always be worshipped and someone will always be served, or something will always be served. So the question is what is worthy of worship or having your allegiance? And what is worthy of serving and being, you could say, an employee and more than that? So one of the things that you see the Torah is saying is do not recreate the systems of a ruthless domination. Because this is spoken to, especially Leviticus, to people who were delivered out of that. So don't just recreate that in a different place with different masters. And the passage we say in Isaiah, as we pick that apart, we're seeing that it is talking about the collapse that comes when humanity rejects what God has promised to put into place. And we'll see how this has a lot of echoes, not only of the passage we just looked at today, but also going all the way back to the beginning of time. And the passage we saw from John 13 is emphasizing that Yeshua is showing us how the true Adonai, who the true Lord and Master, uses his authority to serve those he is calling and saving. So those are the key points, calling and saving, because not all who are called actually decide they want to move forward with it. So thus, we go back to Leviticus 25 for a moment, take a look at that. Well, who owns what? And by looking at this in context of it, these Jubilee laws, or the Yovel, were built on two fundamental claims. Number one, the land belongs to Adonai. And you could see that Israel can possess and steward the land, but it cannot claim absolute ownership. And next week, we'll be taking a look on Leviticus 26, and we'll see a lot of curses from heaven, basically saying, you want to go back on the kinds of freedoms that are talked about here? heaven is going to drop a ton of bricks on you. And there's going to be all kinds of corrections that are going to come as a result of this. And we'll see as how in history the people of God decided that they were not going to let people go free. They were not going to discharge the debts. Because why? Same as it always was. People love having people under their thumb, and they love having people that are indebted to them. So in the process, they wouldn't let it go. Then when they saw that the ton of bricks was falling on their head, they go, and they listen to the prophets and go, yeah, this is the reason why it's happening. Then they decided, okay, well, we'll discharge the debts. We'll let the servants go. Until they realized, oh, we like that servitude. And they went and they rounded them all up again. And then the ton of bricks fell harder on their head. So thus is a lesson for the people of God throughout time is, you know, the lessons of and the instructions of God are not easy for our own will to want to just grab all of it only for ourselves and not realizing who it actually belongs to. Because when you see that in the end, Israel belongs to Adonai, like we talked about earlier, that the Lord delivered Israel from bondage. For what? More bondage or for freedom? Even though you are serving someone else. So that is a hugely important part of this. In case we didn't get it in this passage, our passage ends with, in Leviticus 25, verse 55, for the sons of Israel are my servants. So get the picture here. You have changed masters, but in the process, is the master you're serving worth serving? Because when you see later on in Israel's history, you have a battle then with another master. That's the name of Baal or Baal. Baal means master or Lord. So thus, you end up having a challenge there as it goes on. Do we serve Adonai, the Lord, the creator of heaven and earth? Or do we serve the various variations of Baal, the various storm, fertility, et cetera, deities that promise all kinds of things and promise a, quote, easier way to achieve them. You pay the offerings, you pull the handle, so to speak, and out come the blessings. But really, the punchline of all this is redemption does not make Israel masterless. It just changes the masters. So we see here in Leviticus 25, it's telling us, hey, don't recreate Egypt. Don't recreate it through your treatment of other people in the process. So in this passage here in Leviticus 25, we have the case where it talks about the brother who's becoming progressively poorer until he finally sells his labor. Because here we're talking about in the ancient world that you didn't have credit cards, that you could just run up your debt and you have no collateral whatsoever. You were the collateral. You were the collateral. And if you didn't have land or this or that, you may try to sell off your land to pay your debts. But at the end, you are the collateral. And you know, we even had, going up into the modern era, some sort of ideas of this that were horribly abused called debtor's prison. And that was a vestige of this sort of idea. Okay, so we've gotten to the modern era where you have credit. You can just run up your credit on that. Well, like we've seen in some of the statistics we saw at the beginning of this, we have a number of people who are in slavery or a debtor's prison of a sort by all of the huge levels of credit that they've run up in the process of this or that. So even in the situation that Leviticus 25 is talking about, even if you have someone who's so destitute that they are they're down to their own self as collateral. And then they go, okay, we got to give that up as well. Even then, you have the instructions. They're saying, do not make him perform ordinary slave service. Regard him like a hired worker. So he is, treat him as an employee, which, you know, you could say, well, maybe that's not a big improvement. And even you see in modern eras where even in modern day, you have some employees that are treated horribly. I mean, even physically beaten. And in some cases, that still persists in this country, but in other countries, that has persisted even up into modern times, where you have your boss, to get the message across, will physically beat you or kick you in the shins or something like that. But one of the things that you see in this passage is that you do not rule over him, or bafarech, you do not rule over him ruthlessly, or treating him like he is less than a person. Don't treat him like that. And you see, in the end, he preserves his eventual return to family and ancestral property. So thus, we've got this irony that's being presented. Israel must not escape Pharaoh, may not freed from Pharaoh, only to recreate Pharaoh among themselves, that they become Pharaoh themselves. So remember how Exodus begins in the first earlier chapters, that they cry out to heaven for all of this slavery that is being, and the servitude and the harsh treatment that was being put upon them. Heaven heard the cry and said, okay, we are going to then send deliverance in the process. So the lesson here, and as we come down to Leviticus, is, hey, don't do the same thing to those people who are now under your control. So you were under Egypt's control before, but now you got people under your control. Don't take advantage of them. And you take into modern days, like we were talking about with bosses, hey, if somebody is in your control or under your purview, you don't treat them like less than people in the process. You know, you have to move forward and sometimes give some motivation, but you also have to do so as if you're dealing with people, not with a property or an object or something like that. In a parallel passage that we have seen here recently, and we were talking about with the Shemitah, and we went to Deuteronomy 15, that's kind of like the parallel view that we see. Leviticus 25 is the picture of the Yovel or the Jubilee, and then you see Deuteronomy 15 is talking about the Shemitah or the sabbatical year, every seventh year. And one of the things we see there in Deuteronomy 15 is you can't reproduce that immediate poverty just by releasing the person. So when it says in Deuteronomy 15, 13, when you set him free, you shall not send him away empty-handed. Because, okay, he's worked for you all that time, he's got nothing. And then you're just going to say, okay, get lost. Yeah. It's like, you know, some cases where they just give somebody a bus ticket, no money, nothing, just, okay, drop you off somewhere. And it's like, now, okay, now what? You don't have any money, you don't know anybody, et cetera. So in this case, at the end of the service, you're to give him a severance package. Oh boy, doesn't that sound familiar? It's similar to what we have in today's society, because when you leave a job, right? I mean, sometimes you have the ability to be going into your next job immediately, but even if you have the next job immediately, there's still a lag, right? And when you start getting paid by your new employer, so there will be some sort of a lag. And even today, you can sometimes get a severance package in the process of it. So one of the things that the former master must supply resources from his own prosperity, because where did the master's prosperity come from? The servant. And the employer got it from the employee. So a lot of when people talk about, well, you have these fat cats or whatever, and they just rack up their millions. Well, where did the millions come from? came from the workers and what the workers produce, et cetera, et cetera. So you can have people will then produce wealth, and the wealth will grow bigger because of what they contribute in there. So for the employer, it is not a zero-sum game. Oh, the worker comes in, and then I've got to pay him on his way out. No, the worker came in and provided you, the employer, with a benefit and gain in the process. So thus, you are thanking, and really thanking your boss for the benefit that you had in this worker being in your midst. Always remembering who serves whom in the process. And the bosses, the masters, need to learn who it is they serve in the process. And that should probably start getting some bells going on in your head on a parable that Yeshua told about a guy who had a master, went to his little sub-masters and said, okay, hey, pay up. So what did they do? They went down to the people who were under them, got them to pay up. And then you see what would happen if somebody did not actually come through and then pay their upper master. Then what happens? In the parable, you saw the little submasters got what? Yeah. They came under all kinds of scrutiny from the headmaster. Indeed. So this is the lesson that Yeshua telling with the parable. Treat those who are responsible to you well, because why? You are responsible to someone above you in the process. Yes, it was one of the parables. We'll get a passage for you on that later. So it's one of the Gospels. So I'll get that to you. It's one of the servant and debt parables. One of the things that Israel must always remember, we are slaves and Adonai redeemed us in the process. But biblical freedom is a realistic opportunity for you to start again. And that is the message for Israel in the process. Because remember we were talking about with the second generation going into the land? The second generation had to learn that they were starting over with what God was doing. They were starting over. They were starting over for what God had started with Israel coming out of Egypt. The first generation, they did not want to trust the one who was leading them. They did not want to trust. So what indeed happened in the process of that? That generation could not go in. They could not go into the promised land. They had to basically live out their lives outside of the promised land. Their children, who they worried would not go in because they weren't being protected, the one who delivered Israel out would also deliver that second generation in. And that is what a little microcosm of these sabbatical years, the Shemitah and the Yovel or the Jubilee, is representing on this and reminding every time they come around, hey, remember what you've been freed from and remember where it is you're going. So yes, and for those who may need a little bit of a refresher, even though we've been talking about it for the last few weeks here, Shemitah, every seventh year, you're having a agricultural rest, a fallowing of the ground, and the debt is discharged. And as we've seen in previous passages, the land is producing for 6 years, then in the seventh year, nothing. You are just letting it rest. And then you start what? Planting in the eighth year. But when does your crop then come in? Yep, ninth year. So you've got to have a whole lot of trust in the process. And as we'll see next week, there was a lot of trust issues with the people of God, as we've always had throughout time, in trusting that the Lord was actually going to provide. Either during the Exodus, are you going to provide water? Are you going to provide food during this journey in the wilderness? And then later on, when the Lord says, hey, you let the land rest, what do you do? Do you let it rest, or you just say, it's mine, mine, mine. I've got to get it. I've got to get, forget six years of an increase. I want all seven. Are you smart or are you stupid? Well, that gives the perspective is, where do you notice whether smart or stupid is? And as we see, when we get down to the end of the book of Deuteronomy, where he's saying, choose life or death. They're presented both before you, life and death. Well, choose life. Or to put it in literalist terms, turn smart or stupid. Stupid is as stupid does. But that's a sad thing that we all have to learn throughout our lifetimes, is what that line is between life and death. To what between wise and stupid, or short-sighted, or full of folly, as the old phrase goes. So, getting by while the getting's good. So, yeah. So that's what you're seeing here is with the cycles of sevens, and that seven is a number in the Bible that shows up a lot, and that thing, the cycle of it works for 6 days and it stops on the seventh one, boy, that should sound familiar, because that's what we're celebrating here today is the weekly Shabbat or the Sabbath, and that comes all the way back from creation, because it says, hey, God created in 6 days, and he stopped on the second day, so thus you do every single week. And then he also says for the cycle of the Shemitah, or the sabbatical year, the land is working for 6 years, and then you stop. And then when you take those seven sevens cycles, Shemitah stacked upon each other, you get seven of those sabbatical years. And then the year after that is the Yovel, or the Jubilee year, so the 50th year. So thus, you should be learning between the Shemitah and the Yovel cycles that, hey, who actually owns this thing that I'm gripping my fingers around all the time? Who actually owns it? Yes, the creator of it all, and the one who leads us. He is the one who actually owns everything. So thus, my dealings with the land, the things he's created, with other people around me, should be in gratefulness and thankfulness in the process. Yeah, gratefulness and thankfulness. And also with what? Mercy and favor. Because why? The master, you know, the Adonai, the creator of it all, had favor upon us. So thus, we have favor upon those around us. That should sound familiar, something that you hear quite often throughout the Gospels, isn't it? Yeah. So yes, in the Yovel, after these seven cycles of 7 years, you then have the restoration of a person to the person's family, and the family to the ancestral property. And so thus, one of the lessons that was coming in there is, hey, reconnect people with family. Boy, is that a message for today or what? What is one of the problems that we have in today's world? Everybody just scatters from their family, and people don't really connect with family much, connect and relate to them. The younger generations to the older generations, the older generations to the younger generations, and becoming disconnected from where you come from, then can lead us into wondering, well, who are we? Where are we going? Why are we here? All these kinds of issues that you see in today with loneliness, incredible amounts of loneliness are just, we saw the epidemic levels of statistics related to debt at the outset of today. Well, if you can see similar statistics on loneliness are just heartbreaking about how many people in the past few years have become accustomed to not connecting with hardly anybody at all throughout the week, and having fewer and fewer and fewer connections with even your friends or so-called friends or acquaintances. So So as we move on further, you see that the Shemitah and the Yovel, especially the Yovel, the Jubilee, is something the Torah gives as an economic break, that no Israelite creditor, landholder, or master becomes the absolute owner because Adonai remains the owner. And some people have, some economists have gone back and taken a look at some Yovel or Jubilee similar sorts of systems that were in the ancient world. And that led to some more stability. If you could, that's the key thing. If you can tolerate that kind of reset, because in ancient writings, when they talk about attempts to do just like that with a Yovel, you had a similar thing happen like you see in the Bible, because those who lend do not want to do what? Forgive. They don't want to let it go. And they don't want to prorate it like you see with the Yovel. Your debt is only proportionate to how much time you have left until when the Jubilee comes. Because when that comes, it's over. Your debt is thrown out. It goes out. So thus, when you're a lender, there is also a you have to be reminded who is the boss above you. Because if you're just thinking, I'm in it for myself and grabbing everything I can, then you are not, you're going to want to blow past the Jubilee year and take the debt well beyond that. Because, you know, we see what happens when people get into a situation. It's like, well, are you going to want to lend to somebody who is going to just have the debt discharged in a couple of years? Would you want to lend to that person or not? Then you can see their debt load becomes toxic. No one wants to take it on. And you see similar things happen in today's world. If you have loans that are about ready to come due, you'll start seeing people be less interested in refinancing for you. Because why? They see you're coming up on a cliff. And they see you're dangling on the cliff. And they know you're desperate. So they can hold out for longer or better terms or higher rates or this and that and the other. In other words, it's exactly what they talk about in Leviticus 25. Do not take advantage of people because of how much time is left until the Jubilee comes. Do not take advantage of people in their distress or in their duress. Do not take advantage of them. So when we move over to the passage we looked at in Isaiah 24, and it looks like completely disconnected from what we were talking about, how could this possibly be a parallel passage? But when we start seeing it in the context of the whole book of Isaiah in the passage where it is actually in Isaiah, you start seeing some things start to come into focus. Isaiah chapters 13 through 23 are all these various oracles that go to all kinds of various nations. So several nations are talked about over the span of 10 chapters. But you see in Isaiah 24, it does not start with that kind of a formula like you see in preceding chapters, where it says, you know, an oracle to such and such country, to Babylon, etc. It doesn't come like that. This is just, you start seeing language that is very similar to the beginning of Genesis, Genesis chapter 1. And you see that this judgment becomes earth-wide or all across the land. And it's a very interesting string that you see in these verses where it talks about the rich and the poor and the master and the servant, the lender and the borrower, the buyer and the seller. All of them are being brought low. All of them are being wrapped up in this desolation that's coming. And you see the reason why it's coming. It talks about that in Isaiah 24:5. They violated laws, they altered statutes, they broke the everlasting covenant. In other words, they forgot who the boss was and just lived like there was no boss. And that's a common theme that you'll see throughout the book of Isaiah and Jeremiah. You know, they people living like there is no God. God does not see. God does not have any clue as to what I'm doing here. So thus, I can do whatever I want to whoever I want and take it out and take advantage as much as I possibly want. But you see the callback from the passages in Leviticus, it's, hey, respect God's boundaries. And as we'll see as we get on in later on into the books of the Torah, you'll even see that more specifically stated, hey, do not move people's boundary stones, which is basically their property markers. Do not decide, that guy doesn't need that much property. I'm just going to move his property in because I want that, and just take his boundaries and move them in because you want some of their property. So thus, you're talking about what? Envy, and also about respecting about people's boundaries. And that comes down into modern language today when you start talking about interpersonal boundaries and say, hey, you're overstepping my boundaries, or you're pushing in on my boundaries. Or some people need to be taught they need to set boundaries, because they don't think they're worth anything. So they think their boundaries either are so small or they don't exist. So people just trump right over the top of them all the time. So some people need to be taught, hey, you are valued. Heaven sees you with high value. So you need boundaries around yourself to keep people from taking advantage of you and encroaching in upon you. So thus you have the lesson there is, hey, you do not move people's boundaries. And heaven sets these boundaries for saying, hey, this is how you should treat people. So when we get down to the book of Isaiah, you get this lesson that human beings are called, especially those who are called by his name, don't cross these boundaries. We were talking 2 weeks ago about a pretty nasty phrase that the Lord uses and says, my name is blasphemed or made common, made of no effect among the nations because of you. So those who are supposedly people of God are not acting like they are people of God or listen to anything he said in the way they're treating people and the way they're behaving, either just like everybody else or worse than everybody else. And so thus, people say, well, who's your boss? Well, they find out who your boss is, and then they start thinking what? Poorly. We see that today. When some employee acts badly, people then do what? They take it out on the employer. They start thinking that the employer is bad because of how the employee is acting. So thus, that comes into all kinds of questions today as to how do employees behave? And does that only extend to the time when you are working there on the particular property? How far does it extend out beyond the property? And that then can relate to how closely an employee is associated with the company in everybody's mind. Your reputation, what are you known for? Because, you know, if you are working off hours, yet you're in an employee uniform, and then you start doing something reprehensible or saying something reprehensible, that's reflecting on whom? Your employer starts reflecting on that. Or if people these days can dox pretty much anybody and find out who they work for, et cetera, and pretty quickly. So it's become very difficult even nowadays to try to separate your, quote, personal behavior from your, quote, professional behavior. So then, what should that suggest to everyone? Especially in the modern age, but it should really be in any age. Your behavior should reflect what? We used to call that character, that your character is the same no matter where you are. So whether you're at home, whether you're at work, your character should be the same. So thus, if you have good character at the workplace and at home and in other places like that, then, you know, there is something that can't be looked down upon. Now it goes into a different realm if people just don't like a good character. And that you can see in some places today, some good character is looked down upon. So thus, there is not really a lot you can do. And we've got examples in the Bible. We think of Daniel as a good example of that. His character was the same, so much so that his enemies counted on his character being the same to try to trap him. So in that case, his good character, wanting to worship the creator of heaven and earth, was a trap that his enemy used to try to get him, because they knew that he would be the same in his house versus when he was on official duty. But when he was on official duty, his devotion and service was to his boss. There, he was working for... put it into modern parlance, several administrations that he worked for there, starting in Babylon and then into Persia and then Media Persia. So he went through several administrations, yet he was the same throughout all of it. Yes. But one of the things we also see in Isaiah 24 is that when you have a covenant disorder or a disorder between your relationship between heaven and earth, that can lead to a creation disorder or a disorder throughout the world. Because Isaiah talks about 24 is talking about the earth being laid waste, the land, the inhabitants scattered, social distinctions are collapsing, that the earth is mourning and withering, and that the land itself is defiled, and that you have this covenant curse then comes and consumes the earth. As it says there in Isaiah 24:6, a curse devours the earth, and those who live in it are held guilty. So thus you see a kind of a pattern that follows through throughout the Bible in Genesis 3, and some things we've seen earlier in Leviticus 18. And we'll see there also at the end of Deuteronomy in Deuteronomy 28. And what we've seen here recently, we went through Hosea 4. Remember that? With the buying back and redemption of Israel. And we saw it also here recently with Jeremiah 4. We went through. So one of the things that you see is that human rebellion has a ripple effect throughout the world. Things can go downhill. How you treat other people, how you treat the things that God has created, things will go downhill fast. And you see what happens here in the world when people don't treat what God has created with the respect that comes from something that God has created. And they either start trashing, you know, the environment around, or mistreating animals, or all kinds of things can result when you do not respect who your boss is and what your boss has done in the world around us. So yeah, it's not merely spiritual, because remember, spiritual just means that it is not something that is like this table or something you can knock on, but it does not mean that it is immaterial, because it can be actually sometimes more real than real. I use the example of money. Money is spiritual because it has the value that people put on it. And it has the value of more than one person puts on it. Because I can declare myself a millionaire or a billionaire or a trillionaire. But if no one else agrees, what good is that? So if I agree that, you know, these little pieces of paper with the various ink markings on it mean something, and then somebody else recognizes that they mean something, then I can exchange these pieces of paper for that other person's food or goods or something else or service. And we can both realize, hey, there has been some value that's been transferred. But in reality, what have I just exchanged? If you're just looking at this from some visitor to this planet, they go, Oh, this guy brought a paper and then somebody else gave him food. Well, what was on that paper? Was there some sort of special message on there? Well, I guess you could say a special message that says, I put value in this and then I can do something with this. But there's, you know, other things that we value in life that are spiritual, that aren't material, is what? Love. We talked recently about various forms of love, whether you're talking about brotherly love or familial love or romantic love. Those things are not material. But we can see that they have huge material impact. Because why? Because if someone has love, it is what? It is actual devotion. It is loyalty. And that loyalty is something that can go across generations. It can go across all kinds of boundaries and all kinds of troubles that can go along. That love, that devotion, that loyalty can go through all kinds of challenges. That's why you see at many weddings, they always talk about one of the common phrases in the vows is what? Love, hope, and cherish. It's about something in sickness and in health. And you see the Messiah there in the Gospels says something very similar into the standpoint of what God has brought together, let no person separate that. So thus we see that love, devotion is also something that is immaterial. But what happens when you have, for example, just some other spiritual things like money or love, when they break down, what can happen to a society? It can blow up. Even though from the outside, you could say, well, nothing has really changed. They still have this, they still have that. But if the love and their value of things goes out the window, then you can start seeing things unraveling quickly. We were talking earlier in our services today about what can happen in a disaster when you start losing what? Electricity, water, if you're in a humid, hot climate, air conditioning. When you start losing all these things and they go away, you can just have a terrible sorts of things that then happen. So, thus, when we move on here further, we see that in Isaiah 24 is talking about a decreation that is happening. Because people did not seem to want to value, they didn't seem to want to value the one who brought them life. So, thus, you start seeing everything start to unravel. But you see, as the promise moves on further, and as it goes on for the chapters beyond this into chapter 25 through 27, you start seeing a change. You start seeing this banquet for the peoples. You start seeing the death is swallowed up. Maybe things will start sounding familiar. That tears are removed, that there is a hope of the resurrection, that Israel is gathered and that you'll have worship restored in Jerusalem, that basically you have the presence of God there. What does that sound like? That is like a lot of the hope that we have that you see talked about in Revelation, right? It's very much so. So that's why I often counsel people, if you're going through the book of Revelation and the trumpets and the beasts and the things just get completely perplexing, to go through, if you have got a Bible that has a lot of cross-references and they go, and you see in the cross-references, they go back to the prophets, go back and look at those passages that are being referred to in passing and being alluded to in passing there in Revelation. And you'll start seeing that a lot of these things that are talked about in Revelation start to become less bizarre. And it can help you have a more of a firm grounding for the things that you're getting out of the book of Revelation versus coming up with all kinds of scenarios of how things are going to end. Rose has got a comment or a question over here.
Where's the Leviathan?
Oh, yes, the Leviathan. I'm sorry, I just skipped right over that one. Leviathan.
Who is that in that chapter?
Leviathan, it depends on who you ask. You will say, you will have those people who see that the Bible is nothing but the product of sun-stroked goat herders and shepherds wandering around in the Levant or the Middle East. Or you'll say, hey, this is something that is actually from the Word of God. Now, for those who think that this is nothing but the ramblings of people who are sunstroked or are robbing and plagiarizing from the surrounding nations, they would think Leviathan is nothing more than just a sea monster that is something that you see referred to in other ancient Near East literature. But one of the things that you see a number of characters throughout the Bible. You see the serpent, it's there in Genesis. You also see Leviathan. You see the sea. We talked about this when we get around to the Red Sea crossing time period right during in Exodus. You know, and then you also see all kinds of other things together. But when you start seeing a common message throughout all of them, is that this is a power that is trying to topple God's rule upon the world. So basically, you have a force that is coming against. And thus, you see that it has a number of faces and a number of names, because this is a multifaceted force that comes through all kinds of different directions. So thus, to your question, well, what is this Leviathan that is defeated? You see it in very similar passages, like in Revelation, like you're talking about a dragon, or you're talking about some other beast that is held up and chained. So thus, you see a very similar message throughout the Bible. But one of the things that you see throughout this passage as it continues on through Isaiah 25 through 27 is that judgment or correction is clearing the way for a restoration. To put it in more simpler terms, you have to know what the problem is before you can fix it. You have to know what the problem is and acknowledge that there is a problem for you to fix it. You know, we talked about this in previous sessions where in the people who go through some sort of substance or addiction recovery program or something, they know this very well. You have to do what? One of the steps is take a personal inventory. You need to know what the problem is and own up to it. You need to own up to your problem. To use the theological term, confess. You admit to it and say, yep, these consequences that are coming as a result, yep, that is what is due me. So you own up to it and then say, okay, what is the way out of this? There may be some repercussions that come through from what it is that we've done and what we've been involved with. But what is the path out? What is the way out that heaven is providing in the process? Yep, indeed. So, but the goal, one of the things that you see throughout these passages is that heaven does not want to annihilate, to just wipe out or hit the so-called smite button. That is not what heaven is looking to do. But rather, to restore things to where you will have a leader that is worth following. A leader that is worth following. So then when we get to John 13, we see something pretty incredible that Yeshua is not merely a servant among servants, but as it talks about there, the teacher and the master, or the teacher and the Lord. And Ho Kyrios, or the Lord and the master. Now, this is something for a longer discussion, but one of the things that you see that comes, and it was actually a question that came up a couple of weeks ago, is about circumlocutions or talking around something without mentioning something. And people ask that about using terms like God, Lord, things like that, rather than using a personal name or some of the names that are written in there. We have in Hebrew as four Hebrew characters. There are some other names that are much longer. It's a whole phrase. Sometimes the name goes on for a whole sentence on it. So then what is the point of having a circumlocution? It is to do one thing, is to show respect on it. And another case is to also shift the focus to what is the role of the one who you are talking about. You know, people focus on four Hebrew letters, but in the same context in Exodus, it says, you know, Ihye Asher Yihye, which is translated either I am that I am, or I will be who I will be. So that, you could say, is the functional name of the creator of heaven and earth. That's, he is, he exists. So thus, you can either fixate on four characters, or what is it, the role in the person's life? So like we were talking about at the outset, throughout a lot of the Bible, you've got this battle between Adonai and Baal. And the question is, who do you serve? Who is it that you are going to serve? Because both of those words mean Lord, Master, but the question is, what does that actually relate to? What does that relate to? Because you'll see archaeologists will dig up, and you've seen some figurines where you'll see it very clearly say, those four Hebrew letters and his Asherah, or and his wife, or and his woman. And Asherah is also a name for a fertility goddess there of the ancient Near East in Canaan or Canaan. So thus you've got the question, well, who is it that you're serving? They used the right four letters. They used it, but who are they referring to? Well, you know from context that who is normally married to Asherah? Baal, or one of the Baals. One of them. There's a number of them. But thus, you're saying, okay, well, you've used the, quote, right name, unquote, but you're talking about somebody else. So thus, one of the questions that we have throughout the Bible is, who do we actually serve in this? And who is our master? And one of the most common things that you see in the Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures, when you have those four letters, it is most often translated as Kyrios, which translated is roughly Lord or Master or something like that. So when you see quotations that we have in the New Testament, in the apostolic writings, that come directly from passages there in the Old Testament, the Hebrew scriptures, when they're using those four letters in the Hebrew, it's Kyrios in Greek. So thus, when you're seeing it in context, we could just say, well, Kyrios just means Lord and Master. Well, yes, it does. But in context, what is it actually referring to? Who are you referring to in the process? Exactly. To talking about the master of heaven and earth is also called Kyrios. When you see in the Hebrew and translated then to the Greek. So thus, when you see it talked about here in this in John 13, he says, oh yes, indeed I am. I am the didaskalos, or the teacher, but then I am also o Kyrios ho Kyrios, or Lord, 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 Master, Adonai, Adonai. However you want to put that forward. So yes, I am your teacher, I am your rabbi, but more than that. And that is what you see going from the beginning of the John's gospel, right from verse 1 of it. That's, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then going on to verse 14, where it says, the word became flesh and skinued or tabernacled or dwelt or pitched his tent with us. So thus, when you're saying, well, who is it? Who is it is actually our Kyrios? Would we be thinking it's Baal or just some regular master, some regular person, or is it the communication that comes through all the way from the beginning of the Gospel of John saying, no. This is something that we've seen building throughout all of Scripture here, right from the beginning part of it, where God spoke, God said, the word of the Lord came to this person, the word of the Lord came to that prophet, the word of the Lord came to this person, and thus you see the word becoming flesh, and seeing that this is something that God is doing very indiscreetly and directly. So then, you have that message. Then Kyrios gets up, takes on the role of a servant, and then starts washing feet. Washing feet. And you probably heard all kinds of accounts as to how that should have been done. As they were coming in, they should have contracted with someone to come in, you know, bring a little boy to come in to get the quote, garbage job of going to wash people's dirty feet and such like that. Somebody should have taken care of this. Well, point was is that no one did. And knowing how heaven works, it was probably purposely done that way, so no one did do that. Yes, Rose has a comment or a question over here. Yes, and that's what comes later. So thus you see is the pattern of that one, the Kyrios, also becomes the servant or the dolos, as we see this moving on further. Because thus you say, if I then, the Lord and teacher, washed your feet, thus you should wash each other's feet. So if heaven can stoop so low to do this for you, can't we just do something similar to other people around us in the process? How much is it going to hurt us? Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So thus, you see, the question starts shifting from who's the greatest, you know, which one of us has become the master over the thing that Yeshua is starting and moving forward to, oh, this is what authority really looks like. To say, as it begins, we saw in the beginning of John chapter 13, what? Because he knew where he came from. He knew where he was going. So thus, what? He got up and started to act like a servant. He didn't have to try to put on the airs of being the master, being the Lord, the Kyrios. He already was. He knew that. And his servants knew that. And they would get the message more and more as this developed on. So then the message is, like you see in John 13, 16, the slave is not greater than the master. So thus you see that the Kyrios is then acting like the dolos, or the slave or the servant in the process. And this goes back to something that you see, that we should all ask the question, is any kind of service beneath us? And you see a similar thing talked about in Ecclesiastes, that we are to work as if we are working for whom? Working for the Lord, working for Adonai, working for Kyrios. We should work for our employer as if we actually knew, and we do know, who our boss actually is, so that it is our boss's performance that we care about. And our earthly boss benefits from that, because we will then act in great manner, because we are working for the pleasure of our top boss, the boss, the one. That's who we work for. So thus, one of the things you see that comes from this passage is something that goes back to the one of the servant prophecies. There's at least four of them. Some people put maybe five or six of these servant of the Lord passages throughout the book of Isaiah. And the one that a lot of people know is the one related to Isaiah 53. And in particular, you have there quoted in John 12:38 is quoting from Isaiah 53:1, which is probably good for us to take a look at here first off. Yeah, John 12:38. So actually, kind of go up a little bit further, probably go back to, like in 37. But though he had performed so many signs before them, yet they were not believing in him. This was to fulfill the word of Isaiah the prophet, which he spoke, "Lord, who has believed our report, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed?" For this reason, they could not believe, for Isaiah said again, "He has blinded their eyes and hardened their hearts, so that they would not see with their eyes and perceive with their heart and be converted, and I would heal them." So thus we're seeing from a couple of different passages there in Isaiah, one of which, first one there from Isaiah 53, who has believed our report, and another one from earlier on in Isaiah, which is talking about, is something that Yeshua quotes about why he's telling parables. So basically, people who think they know will be confounded by it. Or, as you see talked about in the Gospels, enraged by it. Because they will actually know that the parable is talked about because of them, but they don't want to do what? Submit. They don't want to submit to their boss because they think their boss is somebody else, or they have a different picture of their boss. So kind of like what we were talking about earlier, about who is it that you're serving, Adonai or Baal? And we always have to be careful as to whether our vision of who our boss is starts shifting more over to the Baal category than it is what God actually reveals. And that has been a problem for the people of God throughout time. It's the same as it was then, is the same as it is today. To take the words that our creator of heaven and earth has given to us, and then take them and start making them sound like more of what the adversary of heaven would say. Yes, did God really say? So that is one of those things that you could say is part of deconstructionism. It's like you see a lot of modern critical thought, and it goes back even into the 19th century a bit, is a lot of, it could just be summed up with that. Did God really say? Did so-and-so really say this? Did so-and-so really say that? And then poke lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of holes in it. So thus, if you do enough of that, then you could have the truth right in front of you, and you would not see it, or you would not be willing to see it in the process of it. So indeed, so you see that's talked about throughout Isaiah 53, that the servant of the Lord is chosen by Adonai, that the servant of the Lord obeys his sender, restores Israel, and becomes a light to the nations, suffers rejection, gives himself for others, and is ultimately exalted. So thus you've got the picture of this servant of the Lord: sent, obedient, rejected, self-giving, lifted up, and then glorified, or all of the weight and honor then flows to it. So that's where we'll kind of bring things in for a landing. So yeah, it's something that we all have to really ask ourselves, really, whose servant are we? Are we treating something that Adonai has entrusted to us as though we own it, and we all only own it, only all ourselves, we own it. So thus, we can do with whatever it is and whoever it is, however we want to, and however we think we need to do, without respect for the owner, this and that. And are we using the authority that we have, the money we have, the knowledge, position, just to protect ourselves, or to do what? To serve other people in the process. Because one of the things that we learn is that in serving other people, we end up profiting more. Because one wise one person said is that if you really want to be profitable, you serve other people to their fullness so that they will then see that you are the indispensable place to go. Like if you go to a restaurant and you get fantastic service and the food is great and this and that and the other, what do you want to do? You want to go back. And then you tell other people about them. And then they want to go there. So thus, you see, in the service of it, serving others, you can then have a greater blessing in the process. But the blessing of it and the getting the better blessings is not to do what? Take advantage? No, it is to take the blessings that you've been given and then heap them onto other people in the process. So that in the whole process, other people are benefited because why? We benefited. We have been blessed. We can say, oh, I am blessed in this situation, so I will then bless other people. You start in, if you want to see your daily shift go downhill, you start with the idea, oh man, this is just terrible. Everybody's against me, this and that. And you just, your whole day will start going downhill. And then you'll start treating other people, your coworkers, your customers, your clients. It will go downhill as well. Rather than, I am blessed. And if people say, how are you? One wise person said, I couldn't be better. And that being an affirmation of himself to say, truly, I couldn't be better. No matter if things are going, I think, into the dumper and other people would think it's going downhill, sliding into the cesspool. Rather, take the attitude, it couldn't be better in the process. Because then you are in a position to really then bless other people. Even as we've seen throughout the history of the people of God, even when they are doing despicable things to you, you can bless them in the process. And in the process, also change them. Because one of the things that we didn't get a chance to get to today, but it's a good discussion in this, is some of the lessons that you see throughout the Torah that are talked about with these servants, especially when they talk about, hey, you have these people who come in from other nations, you get them from pagan nations, etc. You're like, well, okay, well, aren't you then just crushing other people? But then you see a very interesting thing talked about, where we call it the Bible's actual fugitive slave law, where if you have a servant who escapes his master from another country and he goes into the land of Israel, he is freed and he can go where he wants. Because one of the things that's being communicated through all this is that you don't oppress the people who are in the land. Because why? You yourself has been blessed, so you don't oppress other people. And if you do oppress other people, watch out, the ton of bricks is going to fall on your head. And that is what the topic of next week is. If you don't realize who your boss is and where all the blessings come from, the ton of bricks will be falling on your head. Matthew 18. Yeah, that's a good parable along those lines as well, for both interpersonal relationships and those within the body of believers. Anne has a comment or a question over there as we close out.
That brings up a big question. I mean, if if you've got 50,000 people swarming the border, what about all those people? Are they to be considered the way we just mentioned just now, that it's that we should welcome them in and take care of them?
Well, that would be a conversation that we could take up next week. But one of the things there is a lot of that people have said over the centuries on just that particular topic. And one of those, they could say, is a Maimonides has a lot to say about that. But there are some other passages that you see throughout the Torah that relate to where he got that from as well. But his basically the idea is that, you know, there is a concept that you see that comes down called the Ger Tzedek, or the righteous foreigner. Now, basically, it's on the path to being a convert, and is actually a big discussion in Paul. When Paul is talking about circumcision and this and that and the other, there's a lot of thought nowadays that what he's getting at were people that were seeing that that the people of Israel in the, under Roman rule were given a lot of leeway from the laws of Rome, especially the worship of the emperor. But if you weren't a, quote, member in good standing in your local synagogue, you didn't get that dispensation from the Roman government, and you would still be subject to the emperor worship, etc. So thus, there was the issue of people either trying to push people into just, you know, going for the circumcision to get your ticket punched, so thus you could be declared free from Rome, etc. So thus, it was no longer like your allegiance to the God of heaven was the sole purpose of what you were doing this for. You were really doing this for some other ulterior motive. And that's something that becomes a huge discussion on what is a Ger Tzedek, and that you should actually have some kind of a, you could say a, maybe a, not a limitation, but a hesitation in declaring somebody a Ger Tzedek or a righteous foreigner. Because what is it that they are doing this for in wanting to come in? Because one of the things that, and this gets into talking, because they also talked about situations as to where if you are a master of a servant from another country and you move to the land, does that discharge your servant who's serving for you? Or if you're living in the land and then you leave the land, do you take the servant with you or not? And so a lot of those things then get into the question of a Ger Tzedek or a righteous foreigner in this regard, and whether someone is doing this because they really have a love for heaven, or whether they're just trying to, you know, get out of a particular situation in the process. So the idea of, I could say, similar to the idea of bringing someone into your family just for the sake of, quote, evangelizing them is a process. In a similar way, do you bring people into your family as your workforce with the idea of, quote, evangelizing them? And in the process, you, if there is too much of an influence of people who really don't believe as you do, rather than influencing them, they influence you and your children and everybody around you. So that is an ancient discussion that goes back hundreds, even thousands of years now on that very, very topic of this. Because that is extremely unique in the ancient Near East, the fugitive slave law in what you see in the Torah. Because that was not, when you see like the code of Hammurabi, it was the opposite. It was what we enacted during the Civil War or leading up to the Civil War time period, where even if someone fled to another, to a northern state, to a free state or something, you would have to send them back to their slave state in the process. The Torah's law regarding this was quite different from that. So Yeah, great, great question. If you'd like to take that up, we could launch into that next week as maybe a preface to that or something related to that, because that is it's a very important question that comes up on that.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info, hallel.info.